This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, and today we're going to talk about something very interesting about behavior and maybe where some of our behaviors might come from a place that one man at least is known to look for. That, and this year's invited speaker for the Colleges of Science and Mathematics and Arts, Humanities and Social Sciences at NDSU. Their annual community lecture this evening at the Fargo Theater will feature Dr. Franz de Waal. He will present the lecture, The Bonobo and the Atheist, Morality, Religion, and Pro-Social Primates. That's also the title of his book. De Waal is a Dutch-American biologist known for his work on the social intelligence of primates, and he joins me in studio today. Thank you for being with us, Dr.
De
Waal.
I'm happy to be here.
Well, what attracted you to study primates in the first place?
Oh, I'm very attracted to the comparison with humans. We are primates, after all, and so we have a lot of psychological features in common, and that's what I'm interested in.
And why bonobos? Why those of the primates?
Bonobos and chimpanzees are our closest relatives. So if you look at the genes, at the DNA of the bonobo and the chimpanzee, it is 98.5% identical to human DNA. So basically, they're barely different from us, even though some people think that they're quite different from us. So that 1.5% is maybe doing quite a bit, but they're very closely related to us.
Now, the intriguing part of this is how closely related to us they might be in terms of behavior. So tell us a bit about the experiments that you've undertaken and the results that you've witnessed.
Yeah, I'm very interested in the level of cooperation and how they resolve conflict. Like, for example, chimpanzees and bonobos, they reconcile after fights. How they express empathy and take care of each other. So, for example, if one of them is distressed, let's say a chimpanzee has lost a fight and is screaming, then others will come over and embrace them and try to calm them down. Or bonobos do these things sexually. They try to calm them down sexually, so that's sort of interesting. So I look at that kind of behavior, and I'm interested in everything that relates to how to keep a society together. The positive side of behavior, even without denying that there's a lot of competition at the same time within these societies, and that's sort of the dilemma: how do you maintain a harmonious, cooperative society even despite the conflict that's going on? And that dilemma, of course, we humans solve that with our moral rules. We have rules about how you should behave, and so all the things that these primates do is related to human morality. It's not exactly the same, but it involves related capacities.
Well, let's delve into the title of your book, The Bonobo and the Atheist. I assume that you might be the atheist in this discussion?
No, even though I'm a non-believer, I'm sort of reluctant to call myself an atheist because atheism has gotten this flavor that they are anti-religion, and I'm really not anti-religion. I'm sort of indifferent to
And the bonobo would be indifferent to religion.
Yeah. So for me, that's not the issue, is to attack religion. But I do believe that when people say that morality comes from God and from religion, they are exaggerating. I think religion plays a role in the morality of our societies, but the source is really human psychology and primate psychology in general. Because it's very hard for me to imagine that 100,000 years ago or 200,000 years ago, our ancestors did not have a sense of right and wrong and did not have a sense of fairness and did not punish bad behavior in their societies. So they must have had a moral system, even though our current religions are, of course, much more recent. They're like just 2,000 or 3,000 years old.
So there's reason to think that these behaviors, this empathy, this compassion or whatever, has some practical social purpose.
Oh, yeah. My thinking is that, for example, empathy, let's take that, is that you're sensitive to the emotions and the situation of somebody else, which is the basis of morality. We would not have a moral system if you didn't care about others. So that's very simple. To have empathy with others is necessary for a group living animal like a chimpanzee or like an elephant, for that matter, or a dolphin. You need to, if you survive by living in a group, And these animals are not capable of surviving on their own. For example, a primate on its own is going to die. Is probably going to die to predation. So if you survive by living with others, you need to take care of others. You need to be interested in them. You don't need to take care of everybody, but certainly take care of your family members and your best friends, the ones with whom you cooperate. So you need to be sensitive to their situations.
Well, the remarkable thing, if you go online, you can actually see a lot of Dr. De Waal's work shown in videos that exemplify exactly what he's talking about. And some of these demonstrations are just amazing. amazing. The yawning demonstration, for example, that chimpanzees or bonobos do this just like we do it.
Yeah. So yawn contagion is related to empathy in the sense that people who are high on empathy, they also are more sensitive to the yawns of others. And that's because empathy runs partly through the body. So if you have a sad expression, I will have a sad expression. If you're smiling and laughing, I will be smiling and laughing. And I will start feeling similar to you through my sort of body synchrony. And yawn contagion is part of that. And we test yawn contagion in chimpanzees. We show them little videos. They look at a little video of a chimpanzee yawning, and they start yawning themselves. The same thing has been done with dogs, by the way, and dogs do the same thing. They yawn when the owners yawn. And even in the most recent experiment, they audio taped a yawn of the owner. So all that the dog got was some sort of the sound of his owner yawning. And even that makes them yawn.
And that's probably why we like dogs so much. They're very empathetic, or they seem very social creatures.
I think the reason why many people have mammals at home, like cats and dogs, and not iguanas or turtles or snakes, is because we like that kind of emotional connection that we have with mammals. Yeah.
There was another interesting video that I saw up there that's actually quite old. It's 1937, I think, vintage. It's a black and white video that shows a couple of chimpanzees working together to get a platter of food toward them. They're basically both pulling ropes, and if they didn't, it wouldn't come to them. They have to work hard at it.
Yeah, so this was Robert Yerkes, who 100 years ago already, I work at the Yerkes Primate Center, but 100 years ago already, he and his students, they tested out a lot of these capacities. And so he had these young chimpanzees that had to cooperate, and he set up a situation where one of them, he would feed one of them. So one of them all of a sudden was not motivated anymore, because the main motivation is to get food that they have to bring in together. And then you see the other one activating, the one who's getting lazy and is not interested anymore, and slapping him on the back and getting him to work, you know?
Yeah, and there was another fascinating demonstration, more modern, involving capuchin monkeys and the difference between a cucumber and a grape. Can you describe that experiment?
Yeah, that's an experiment on fairness. And you know, empathy is one leg of the moral system, but the sense of fairness and justice is the other leg, and it's very important to us. And many philosophers, of course, have written entire books about the sense of fairness, and they usually explain it in a very cognitive, like intelligent, like reasoning and logic type of manner. And they were very unhappy when we found the sense of fairness in monkeys, because they had never thought of this as a possibility. But what we do with the monkeys is we have two monkeys side by side. They need to do a very simple task. One of them gets cucumber slices for the task. The other one gets grapes for the task. If they both get cucumber or both get grape, they're perfectly fine. They will do this 25 times in a row without any problem. But if one gets cucumber, the other one gets grape, the grape is so much better than cucumber, the one who gets the grapes very soon starts protesting and throwing the food around and refusing the task and gets very agitated. I compare it sometimes with the Wall Street protest in the sense that we are very agitated about the bonuses of the bankers, for example. We say, why don't we get these bonuses? And that's a bit the reaction that monkey was showing. Why don't I get grapes?
But it seems almost like they're playing it forward. They both want to get the grapes.
Yeah.
And so there's like the other monkey's basically supporting the case of the monkey that's the successful monkey.
Well, the thing is that they compare. And so, of course, officially, they're not supposed to do that. If you look at the animal literature, it usually says you work for a reward. The reward needs to be good enough for the work that you perform, and then you're going to be happy. But no one ever talked about animals comparing. So this monkey would normally be happy with cucumber slices, but now that the neighbor is getting grapes, the cucumber is all of a sudden not good enough anymore. And so, like we humans, we compare incomes also. I may be perfectly happy with a small salary of, let's say, $30,000 until my neighbor who does exactly the same work gets double the salary. At that point, I'm totally unhappy.
So it seems that we need to kind of nudge our thoughts of what is higher thinking if we want to make it a human element. What is higher thinking?
Yeah, so in a way, by making these comparisons, I bring down humans a little bit by saying, well, actually, things may be simpler than you think. And also lift up animals a little bit by saying, well, these animals actually have tendencies that we that we take for granted in ourselves, but they're present in these animals.
So what does all this say about evolution? Or does it say something about evolution? Are we looking, for example, at bonobos that millennia from now will be communicating at a higher level?
Well, the thing is, of course, with the apes that we have now, they're going to be happy if they survive mm-hmm. because they're all in danger. So don't expect too much evolution from them coming. But I do, of course, believe that all these tendencies that we see in humans that relate to morality, that they have an antecedent, that they come from our primate ancestors, and maybe not immediately from bonobos and chimpanzees, because there are actually there's 5 million years between us, but from our ancestral types. Yeah.
Speech and language, we use that as a way to define, you know, the human ability to communicate. We have words that we put together. We string them together in languages and try to make sense. What about bonobos and chimpanzees? They don't necessarily have the vocal apparatus we have, but they do have a more complicated communication process than I thought of.
Yeah, they have definitely communication, and it's actually quite advanced. But they don't have language the way we do. And of course, there's some attempts to teach language to apes, like with sign language or with certain symbols that they need to point out on a keyboard. And the apes are able of communicating symbolically about certain things, and that's a big step. And before these experiments were done, no one believed that it would be possible. But the apes are doing that. But still, it doesn't really amount to language the way we have. And so if you ask me what is the difference between us and the apes, that's the first one that would come to my mind, is human language.
Now, you mentioned dogs, but there is a demonstration that I also saw involving elephants, mm-hmm. and I think it was fairness, too.
In elephants, we do experiments on cooperation. So we set up a test where, it's very difficult to do it. Josh Plotnick, my former student, does that in Thailand with elephants, where he sets up a test where they need to bring in an apparatus and they need to pull it at a rope at exactly the same time. If the one of them pulls before the other, the whole rope disappears and they cannot pull it in. And so then we make life more difficult for the elephants by sending one of them first, and so that one needs to understand. He needs to wait for the other, and because only when the two are together can they pull in the apparatus. And elephants are very good at this. Elephants are extremely smart animals who can do all these things, much better than, for example, dogs would do.
And in the demonstration I saw, actually one elephant almost fooled the demonstrator by stepping on the line. So
one would stand on the rope. Instead of doing the work, he would put his big foot on it and then let the other one do all the work. So they're smart enough to do that also. Yeah.
Well, let's talk a little bit about intelligence in animals. Yeah. I mean, we measure the brain in a certain way. We call it an IQ or intelligence quotient. But what is a reasonable way to measure the intelligence of an animal?
Well, every measure needs to be adapted to the animal. So one example, for example, is they try to test if elephants can use tools. And what they do is they put some food outside the cage and they give the elephant a stick and they see what the elephant does. Now, for a chimpanzee, that's not a problem. He will pick up the stick and bring in the food. The elephants never did that, and so they concluded elephants cannot use tools. That's a very big conclusion. And later, people started to do more intelligent experiments with elephants. So intelligence testing takes intelligence, so to speak.
There you go.
And what they did is they put a box in the enclosure with the elephant, and they hung the food very high. And the elephant immediately started moving the box under the food so that he could stand on it and reach the food. And their conclusion was that elephants don't like to pick up sticks because when their smelling organ is their trunk. And so if they pick up a stick, they close their smelling organ. They don't like to do that. And so that's why they don't pick up sticks but are willing to move a box to stand on top of it.
And they don't have fingers, of course. So.
No. So you need to adapt your experiments to the abilities of the animal. Yeah.
We're talking with Dr. Frans de Waal. We'll have more of our discussion in just a moment.
Support for this program is provided by the North Dakota Education Association, an organization of 8,000 school employees working to ensure great public schools for every child.
Tonight's television lineup on Prairie Public features 2 hours of The Dust Bowl, tonight's episode, Reaping the Whirlwind. Then at 9 Central, Frontline presents Top Secret America, 9/11 to the Boston bombings. Tune in tonight on Prairie Public.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. In the background, the music of Hesperus, an early American quilt is the name of the CD. Hesperus, the artists. Dr. Franz DeWall is my guest today in studio. He is appearing this evening at the Fargo Theater in downtown Fargo. It's at 7 o'clock. It's free and open to the public, and he's talking about The Bonobo and the Atheist, Morality, Religion, and Pro-Social Primates. So the bonobo is something that looks to most of us like a chimpanzee, but it is a distinct great ape. And this particular event is put on by the Colleges of Science and Mathematics and Arts and the College of Humanities and Social Sciences at NDSU. Dr. DeWall, what kinds of questions are you looking for in the next line of experiments?
Are we doing at the moment cooperation tests where we make life a little bit more difficult for the chimpanzees? So instead of just bringing two of them into a room, they live normally in a large group, so we call them in by name and they come into a room and to do a test on them. We now do the experiment in the open where everyone is present. So there's 15 chimpanzees present, meaning it creates a real problem because now let's say if I want to cooperate with you to get food, there's going to be the dominant male who walks in and maybe wants to take all the food. Or there's maybe someone who steals food from us and try to grab it before we can reach it or something like that.
What is the actual social construct of a group of bonobos? Is it matriarchal? Is it patriarchal? Is it alpha and that kind of thing?
Well, in chimpanzees where we do the experiment, it's males who dominate the females, and it's usually multiple males that we have in a group. In bonobos, it's actually very different. In bonobos, the females dominate the males. So the bonobos are sometimes called the politically correct primate because they are female dominated and they have all sex in all combinations and so.
And you do make a point of that actually. Mm-hmm. It's known for its high levels of sexual behavior, sex functions in conflict, appeasement, affection, social status, excitement, and stress reduction.
Yeah.
Sort of the all-purpose emotion.
I guess. So bonobos are sort of hippies. They're peaceful. They don't have a lot of violence. And they resolve conflicts with sex.
Are they atypical in the primate species?
They're somewhat atypical in the sense that there's actually very little violence. And when groups meet, instead of fighting with each other, they sometimes mingle and have sex with each other, even though there is some hostility between them. And the female dominance is definitely quite different. Most primates don't have that.
Now, I think, I guess if I look at human social construct, I see alpha males everywhere, but it doesn't have to be that way.
Yeah, I think human males are more like chimpanzees.
Okay,
human males are very I wrote a book, Chimpanzee Politics, which is about power struggles and how they form coalitions to outcompete each other. And so if I cannot beat the alpha male, I'll make an alliance with you and we will do it together, you know. And that's very human male-like, and that's also very chimpanzee male-like.
So what's the ultimate aim of your research? Where do you see it going?
I'm interested in social cognition and where does our social cognition comes from. I'm very interested in the integration of societies. So instead of focusing on competition and violence and hierarchies, which I've done for ages, but I'm now much more focusing on how do they work together, how do they resolve their issues, how do they manage to have a harmonious societies, which most of the time they have. How do they manage to do that?
Well, in the human societies, we've evolved various ways of doing it, theocracies, democracies, other kinds of governments, and religion has played a significant role in sort of cementing what should be ethical and moral behavior. How do you really look at that, that construct, from the perspective of somebody who studies primates?
Yeah, I think religion is unique. I don't think primates have anything that I can relate to religion. I think what religions do for human society is codify moral tendencies that we already have, that were not invented by religion, but they codify them, and emphasizing them, and then installing a god who oversees you, and maybe in large societies that is necessary, because instead of primate societies where everyone keeps an eye on everybody, and human societies in the old days, which were small, where that was possible, we now live in societies of thousands of people or millions of people, and we cannot keep an eye on everybody. And so that's maybe where religion comes in.
And I've heard this described, your research with bonobos and other primates, as studying kind of an evolved morality, the way that animals use these behaviors to live together.
Yeah, yeah. And I think humans have taken that a step further. But the basic tendencies, what I call the building blocks of morality, they are ancient. They relate to group cohesion, and many of them can be found in bonobos and chimpanzees.
And you have recently had research begun to seriously address the role of evolution in human mental life. So,
yeah, so I'm interested in where do human tendencies come from. Human society is quite different, actually, from, let's say, chimpanzee or bonobo society. First of all, it's much bigger. Mm-hmm. We live in groups that are much bigger. And second, we have this family structure of male, female, children, which is pervasive in human societies. And chimps and bonobos really don't have that. And so there's some limitations to the comparison. But I think a lot of the basic human psychology, especially our emotional, socio-emotional psychology, is very similar to what you see in chimps and bonobos. We care about the same things, like men care about power. That's true for chimps too. We care about sex. We care about family life. We care about security. We're territorial. So we have many tendencies in common with them.
Do primates, though, ever demonstrate this tendency we've seen actually demonstrated to our horror just recently, that is to just inflict fear, to terrify?
Yeah, chimpanzee males, between groups, they do that. They may enter the territory of another group and start killing off individuals. So they do that. They never do it on the scale that humans do. So, for example, genocide that we know in humans, of course, that's not a primate thing to do. That's a uniquely human feature of which we can be very proud, I'm sure.
Well, another uniquely human feature is our ability to kind of learn and learn new technologies, new ways of doing things. And I think the kind of the fear in the back of my mind is that someday that technology gets to the point where just about any human being could literally destroy a large piece of his neighborhood or the world or whatever.
Well, that would be very sad because you know that there's going to be someone who's going to do that.
And so this research becomes more important.
Yeah. No, I look at how primates can handle that kind of emotions, yeah.
Well, you mentioned that your experiments now are looking at cooperation in groups.
Uh-huh.
What have you seen?
Well, we're very interested in that the chimpanzees can handle that situation. So people had assumed that we were the only ones who could handle competition in a cooperative context. But actually, the primates are very good at it. And so they punish individuals who don't do the right thing. They avoid individuals who are not cooperative, and so they're extremely successful with it.
So their societies are not terribly unlike ours in terms of having unique individuals that are treated in a special way because of the way they behave.
Yeah, so there are individuals, of course, they have all the personality types that you can imagine. There are individuals who are very generous. There are individuals who are very stingy. There are individuals who try to dominate everybody, who beat up everybody, and they sometimes get into trouble over that. There are others who are very submissive. And yeah, no, the whole scale that you see in human society.
Well, I have to say that looking online and looking into your work, it makes you consider animals in a different way, frankly, and I think that's useful to me and maybe to some other folks, too.
Yeah. I will talk about that tonight for sure, yeah.
All right. Well, thank you very much. Yeah. Dr. Franz De Waal is speaking this evening, 7 o'clock at the Fargo Theater, free and open to the public, and the title is The Bonobo and the Atheist in Search of Humanism Among the Primates. And let me tell you, it's a very interesting study he's been doing, this research and the books he's been writing. It's going to be interesting to those people who attend. So thanks again for being with us today.
You're welcome.
The news is next.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. The oil boom in North Dakota may have some lasting power. In 2008, the U.S. Geological Survey estimated 4.3 billion barrels of recoverable oil from the Bakken Formation. A recently completed assessment of the Bakken and Three Forks formations has roughly doubled those estimates. Officials say new technology is also helping drive the increased potential, making it technically and economically possible to recover even more oil. The USGS says they will continue to monitor conditions in the Williston Basin. This year's delayed start to spring has farmers across the state anxious to get into their fields. Snow can still be found in some parcels of land in North Dakota. Bill Gross is the president and CEO of Farm Rescue and says so far this year they've committed to assisting 25 families in their spring planting. He says they have enough resources to also take on 5 more, but he says No one can get into the fields until they're ready.
We plan on helping at least 30 farm families this spring. But yes, we plan on starting any day as soon as we can get going, and the equipment will run nearly 24 hours a day to help all those farm families.
Farm Rescue helps to plant and harvest crops for farm families experiencing extreme illness, injury, or suffering from effects of a natural disaster. Gross says currently the Farm Rescue database has 700 registered volunteers to help families in need. And overland flooding is closing some rural roads in the northwest part of Grand Forks County. County Superintendent Richard Onstead says crews have put up barriers where needed and continue to monitor the situation. Onstead says the greatest impact appears to be township roads in the McKenna and Niagara areas. He says the good news is the water seems to be slowly receding. He says if the Red River hits 45 to 46 feet, it will likely cause some damage to the county system.
I know, and with past experience up in that northeast of Manville and Oslo area, it can do a lot. There can be a lot of damage up there when the river gets to that level, because I know... with the turtle, with the water from the turtle, and that's backing up right now from the red, even the turtle can do a fair amount of damage once we get up in that northeast corners.
The latest outlook from the National Weather Service calls for the Red River to top out at around 45 and a half feet this weekend. Flood stage in Grand Forks and East Grand Forks is 28 feet. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
And welcome back to Main Street. I'm Ashley Thornburg. A thriving art scene can be difficult to establish, but it's one that plays a vital role in towns, especially to the tourism economy, for one, and building a sense of community, among other things. Terry Aldrich is the executive director of the Minot Area Council of the Arts, and during her tenure of more than a dozen years there, she has fought the devastating flood and had to deal with a somewhat unexpected population boom because of the oil, all while developing this art scene. And she joins me now to talk about her work, including a new first-of-its-kind project for North Dakota. Terry, welcome. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
I get the feeling, Terry, that you are a very busy woman.
Well, it is a labor of love, but yes, we do keep plenty busy here at the Arts Council.
What kinds of projects are keeping you busy?
Well, the Minot Area Council of the Arts does a summer concert series, so we produce 25 free concerts throughout the summer. We do the Integrity Jazz Festival, a USO in the fall, and during the school year, we administer an arts education program called Artists in the Schools, along with providing support to our member organizations and being involved in things across the community, like Art Space Project.
Well, tell me about this Art Space Project here. This is one of the more recent projects that you're working on, I gather, and really it's the first new construction in downtown Minot in 30 years? Is that right?
That is exactly correct. It is the very first new construction, and a very exciting project, and you were correct in saying that it's a new project in that it is just now newly being built. But it is also an old project, if you will, because we've been working on it for a long, long time. So the very first call I received was in about 2003, and I got a call from the then director of our Minot Area Development Corporation, Mr. Paul Lucy. And so that kind of started the ball rolling. He had made contact with someone at ArtSpace, Stacey Mickelson. So it's been being worked on since 2003.
And ArtSpace, we should probably clarify here, is it's kind of an arts-driven community transformation process, trying to build affordable living spaces for artists.
Exactly. They are the nation's largest real estate developer for the arts. And so one of the things that I did when I was asked about them was to begin to do a little bit of research about this particular company. And what I found was a company with a track record of success, and success within the communities where they create these arts spaces. So their mission involves creating and fostering affordable live-work spaces for artists and for arts organizations. And so they have a tremendous record of accomplishing that. And when they build art spaces in communities, or when they revitalize old buildings into art spaces, what always happens is there is a wonderful energy that comes from artists within the space that live there, that work there, that create there. And so it creates a wonderful environment that begins to spark business development and economic excitement all around these properties. And so everywhere they are located across the nation, and I believe that there are probably more than 30 projects across the nation, everywhere that they have been, it has been wonderful growth that has seen. So it's an exciting thing to think that Minot is now the site of a space project.
Well, really, I was looking at the map here. There are 11 in Minnesota, and there were a handful in Seattle, and that was it, at least in the upper-tier states here. There's really a hole that this building is now going to be able to fill.
Yes. It's exciting and perfect timing for us here in Minot because, of course, you mentioned our 2011 flood, and you know, our community is very interesting in that we've dealt with some very difficult issues, but we are all experiencing tremendous growth as a result of the nearby oil industry. So affordable housing for anyone is a premium, and to have affordable housing for artists is just absolutely fabulous.
So walk me through this space here. Kind of paint us a mental picture, if you will. How do these spaces, how are they specifically accommodating toward artists?
Well, that is a great question, because when the spaces, the apartments, if you will, the live-work spaces are designed, they're designed with the idea of wonderful natural light. And so as I walked through the building, and, of course, you know, there wasn't even any sheetrock up yet. It's just kind of two-by-fours walked through a couple weeks ago. And everywhere you could see these wonderful windows and great light, which is something that artists love. The buildings are designed extra space in mind so that the spaces themselves are a little larger than a traditional apartment. And they are also designed with the idea that people will be creating in them. So the flooring is something that's very, very durable, and the design of the space itself is very open and workable. So is that kind of what we're asking, or were you asking more about the building?
Oh, nope, that makes sense. I want to know what kinds of artists are we talking about here? Who can get a space in this building?
Well, artist has a very broad definition.
And fairly
so
subjective.
You might be a poet. You might be a writer. You might be a painter, a sculptor, a singer, a dancer, someone who does design art, you know, graphic design, or even interior design would be considered an art. And they have even gone so far as to consider the healing arts. So artist has a broad definition.
Well, then let's talk about then who gets to decide who lives here. I mean, there is the application process, but then after that it goes to a selection committee?
Exactly. So there may be people who live in the arts-based project, not artists, but when an application is submitted, the applicant themselves indicates on the application form whether or not they are an artist. And then there is, as you said, a review committee, and that committee is made up of individuals from across the Minot community, but also there is a representative from the arts-based properties, and also from, I believe, First Minot Management. So those individuals then will hear the answers to a variety of questions that will be posed to the applicant. The applicant doesn't have to make their living as an artist. They don't have to be employed only as an artist, but they do have to be actively working at their art, have to be passionate about their art or their art form, and they have to have some means of illustrating that they have a body of work. So, for example, a singer might come in and sing a song and show some programs from something that they've been in and show that they're actively working as a singer. Maybe a poet would bring in a body of poetry. A painter might have a portfolio of work. So there needs to be some element of documentation that they are actively working on the specific art form. Then from there, those applications then are reviewed by the panel, and the decision and recommendations are made from that interview.
Okay. And then in addition to this, there's also something of a partnership with the Turtle Mountain Tribal Arts Association. Now, there's a gallery space inside, I gather?
Well, there's not only live-work space, but there's also retail space on the first floor. So the first floor is retail space, and the other floors are live-work spaces. So on that first floor, the Turtle Mountain Gallery will be housed, and so I think it will be very, very exciting because they have some wonderful artists and representing that Native American culture in that space and in that gallery. So in that retail space, the Turtle Mountain Gallery and the Monterey Council of the Arts hopes to have their office there. And then there is yet another retail space that the tenant has yet to be named.
Okay. And, you know, you start accepting applications at the end of June. When does the building, when will it actually be open for tenants to move in?
Well, they've had a couple of informational meetings for individuals who are interested in leasing an apartment. What they have told the individuals at those meetings is that they can say absolutely September 1st. It will be ready for people to move in. However, they are ahead of schedule, so it's looking as though, you know, things will be ready ahead of that time. But for people that are looking to check on their leases or so on and so forth, they can absolutely guarantee September 1.
All right, sounds good. Well, congratulations to you, Terry, and to the rest of Minot as well. Terry Aldrich is the Executive Director of the Minot Area Council of the Arts. Terry, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you.
You can find out more about the project and the leasing agreements, including some of the income guideline breakdowns, at artspace.org. And once you're on that website, click on the Our Spaces tab to find the Minot project. Minot, the magic city. Speaking of magic, or, well, maybe just technology, the show Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. You hear it weekly. Now you can see it without even having to go to Chicago. Doug Hamilton is back, and we're joined by our boss, Bill Thomas. Bill, how is this working?
Well, it's satellites. Satellites make it happen.
So magic. Not magic.
Yeah. You know, wait, don't tell me. I have seen it live a couple of times. And for people who are not recognizing the name right away, which probably very few public radio listeners. But anyway, wait, don't tell me is a comedy news quiz that we run on Saturday mornings. Peter Sagal and Carl Castle and a set of panelists. And they do questions about the week's news, and they're funny about it. And it has been a huge hit for us. I mean, just the listenership and excitement about it as we've carried it have just grown, and it's become, you know, really, really popular program. And I listen to it. My teenage children, when they were teenagers, listened to it and enjoyed it. Even my dog likes it, you know. So it's really funny. But then I've seen it in person, and it is so much funnier in person. You wouldn't believe seeing it all live. It's just hilarious. So, of course, a lot of people do get the chance to see it live as it travels around the country. We've tried to persuade them to come to North Dakota, but no luck yet. So they're doing this thing now where they hook up with some cameras and the satellite, and they do a live performance that then is carried by satellite to theaters across the country, and then you can go to a movie theater and see it. So that's what this is. And so this Thursday night, people in Fargo and Bismarck can, or people who want to travel to Fargo or Bismarck, can go and see it live in a movie theater. We tried to get the theaters in Minot and Grand Forks. They didn't want to do it for some reason. So and those are the only four cities in the state that have theaters equipped to do this. So anyway, that's what we can do. So if you're around Fargo and Bismarck, you can go see it. I expect they'll probably run an edited version of it as a radio show at some point. So you'll probably get to hear it that way if you can't go see it. But it's really, really fun to see them do it live.
Well, for those of us who haven't seen it done live, where is it? Where does it originate?
It originates in Chicago. It's usually produced there, though they do go on the road sometimes and do it from different theaters. And so if you're traveling through Chicago, it is a fun thing to go do and see it. They usually record it on Thursday nights. They do it live on Thursday nights and then broadcast it on Saturday, or most stations run it on Saturday. And if you're in Chicago, you can see it live. But if you're not, this is a way to see how they really do it. So it starts at 7 o'clock at the Grand Theater in Bismarck and Century 10. And both of those theaters, you know, they've been really nice because we've done some other things like this. We did This American Life and Prairie Home Companion, and they both have been really cooperative. We've done some other things with the Grand Theater in Bismarck. They're a great theater to work with. And you can get tickets online for the one in Fargo, but in Bismarck, their online system is not working for some reason, so you have to go to the theater. I think you can probably just figure on going that evening and getting a ticket, and you'll be okay.
How much are tickets?
They are $22. You know, it's more than a regular movie, but it's a live broadcast of a show. And I think that's about the same as they charge, like, for the Metropolitan Opera and some of the other events. They do some sporting events also in this fashion. And now at each of these events in Fargo and in Bismarck, we'll have somebody there. We'll be giving away some door prizes. We'll have a little, Prairie Public table set up to greet people with. So we hope to have a little fun with that,
too. And everybody will have access to the concession counter. So it'll be seeing a radio show, and actually having a snack at the same time.
Right. So
how unusual is that?
Yeah, well, you know, a lot of people listen to the radio in the car, and you don't get popcorn in the car, so it's good to have it at a movie theater.
Especially not that movie theater popcorn.
No, you know, one of the things that's different about this, you know, most people listening to the radio is kind of mostly a solo activity. Even if you're listening to it in the house with other people, you're kind of listening to it as a single one person, you know, and you may go around and somebody may even be listening to a different station. Once in a while, people do gather around the radio, as in the famous golden age of radio stuff, gather around and listen, maybe as a small group of people. This is one of the shows that does encourage that kind of listening sometimes. But what one of the things that's really fun about this is you'll be in a theater with an audience of other public radio people who love this show, and that just really amplifies the experience a lot. It's really fun.
And you'll also have all of those camera shots. It'll be close-ups. You don't see that when you go to the theater in Chicago when they're doing it live. I mean, you'd actually have to run down there and look at them.
Yes.
But there'll be some choices being made by the people who are producing this simulcast, this cinecast, that might be illuminating as well.
Yes, you'll find out why these people are on the radio and not in film.
All right. Sounds like a really interesting show. And again, you can go see it on a Thursday at the Grand Theater in Bismarck or the Century 10 in Fargo. It starts at 7 o'clock. Again, that's a Thursday. Thanks so much, Bill,
for
joining us. Main Street's back with another piece of the New American series, this time focusing on Bhutanese weddings.
Do you have a guest idea, a comment, or a question? It's easy to contact us. Just email mainstreet@prairiepublic.org or send us a message via the Main Street at Prairie Public Facebook page. And you can still call. The Main Street toll-free studio line is 888-755-6377.
And this is Main Street on Prairie Public. This is part of a series called New American Stories, produced by Erica Lorentzen. At weddings, there are different rituals, breaking glass, for example, or receiving a necklace. It depends on the culture. In today's A New American Stories feature, producer Erica Lorentzen visits a Bhutanese wedding in Fargo.
For these Bhutanese refugees, times weren't always so great for a wedding. Many got married in a refugee camp in Nepal. At the Charism Center in Fargo, Bhumika Nepal receives the glass necklace from her groom, Laila Dahal. The necklace is a symbol of marriage in their culture, like a ring is to ours. She will wear the necklace for the rest of her life. Kashi Adhikari, a leader in the community, says divorce is rare.
We believe this sort of ritual is exactly working as making family very stable and not that divorce any sorts of family issue because of this strong cultural bond of, conducting rituals and culture.
Community member Narayan Kanal feels his culture helps hold society together. He says Bhutanese work and cooperate with each other collectively.
One family member cannot do all this type of things. They help each other. People are saying that it is completely a personal matter. Marriage is a personal affair. But according to our culture, we do not think in that way. We think it is related to the society, and we need to be bound by certain rules and regulation.
When immigrant groups first come to an area, it takes a while to accumulate enough people and resources to establish a place of worship. Bhumiko's brother Yadav Nepal says he's not sure why, but the Charism Center won't be available for their use anymore. He says focus now turns to building their own Hindu temple, and he's hopeful. Having fought against the Bhutanese government not to change their religion and culture, Adhikari says it is even more necessary for them now to keep it alive for their children and grandchildren. This is Erica Lorentzen for Prairie Public.
In our next report, some immigrants may feel left out of their new social environment, but we hear from a woman with a message of acceptance of others. This series was made possible by the support of the Humanities Council and the FM Area Foundation. You can learn more at prairiepublic.org/New American Stories. Dakota Datebook is next.
When you hear arts programming here on Prairie Public, know that it is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, and we thank them.
This is Dakota Datebook for April 30th. It was April 30th, and the oil men near Tioga were falling behind schedule. "We should have been drilling by now," said one, "and here we haven't even been able to get our rigs in the field." One might guess the problem was weather or spring flooding, but that April had been among the driest in history. No, the problem was 50 freight cars of equipment arriving from Minneapolis. There simply weren't enough trucks or qualified drivers for hauling it out to the drilling sites. With the Williston Basin considered one of the nation's hottest oil prospects, the lack of workers wasn't the only challenge facing the state. the legislature was handling a hot potato regarding mineral rights. Lieutenant Governor Ray Schnell said, "I've talked to a great many people who sold their land, and it appears without a doubt that the government agents did not inform them that they had the right to keep their minerals." Schnell was referring to about 800,000 acres in McKenzie, Slope, and Billings counties. These acres were considered submarginal because they were unsuitable for growing crops. After buying up these areas, the government had them set aside for cattle grazing. For some people, the land buys were viewed as handouts to smaller ranchers who were hard hit by drought and economic depression. But at $2.80 an acre, Lieutenant Governor Schnell estimated about 90% of these buyouts were closer to foreclosures or seizures by eminent domain. The other 10% of the ranchers, he said, received so-called preference rights based on the number of cattle they owned. Pending legislation would decide whether dispossessed ranchers could buy back the mineral rights. Those who were opposed called this immoral, special interest, improper, and a big grab. It's worth noting, however, that more than 200,000 acres in Billings County was already in the process of being leased to large corporations for oil and gas exploration, and opponents worried that passage of the bill would hold up drilling. Meanwhile, news was coming in that Tioga Petroleum had just completed North Dakota's eighth functioning oil well, and the first to be constructed by an independent oil company from within the state. And so it was, on this date in 1952, that oil production in North Dakota provided a glimpse of the future, both promising and troubling. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Mary Helm. I'm Errol Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from the North Dakota Humanities Council.
Just enough time to remind folks that you can catch Dr. Franz DeWall's lecture this evening at the Fargo Theater. It's at 7 o'clock again. The title, The Bonobo and the Atheist, Morality, Religion, and Pro-Social Primates. Don't let that title put you off. It is a fascinating discussion of what might make us tick. Very interesting. Tomorrow on Main Street, we'll get an outlook on our delayed planting season from Dwight Ockery. He's with the NDSU Extension Service. He'll also discuss the continuing agricultural losses in the Devil's Lake Basin area. So that's all coming up tomorrow. And Ashley Thornburg joins me to talk about something she's working on.
Tomorrow is May, and that means it is Bike Safety Awareness Month. And, you know, some of this is for kids and other cyclists. Make sure your bike is in working condition. Make sure your helmet is up to code and everything. But also just a good reminder for drivers and what to keep in mind as they see an increased amount of cyclists on the road now that it's finally nice enough out to bicycle regularly.
Yeah, I just looked out the window. So you can take the studs off the mountain bike tires.
Yeah, finally.
You can actually get down the street without sliding down the street. At any rate, that's all coming up tomorrow. A little safety, a little ag, a little this, a little of that. It's called Main Street. So if you've got an idea for us, let us know at mainstreet@praypublic.org or go online and check out our Facebook page, Main Street at Prairie Public. We're up there and we're looking for your comments as well. And we're still looking for some pictures of your Main Streets. So send them along. And in the meantime, well, enjoy the fact that spring has sprung and have a great evening.